1320 AM, W248DE, Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. As we prepare to head into the 22nd day of the government shutdown, Feeding Northeast Florida CEO Susan King says traffic is up for the eight counties the food bank serves.
That increase ranged anywhere from a reported 10% to as much as 100%.
Pardoned Capitol rioter Christopher Moynihan from Clinton, New York, has pleaded not guilty to allegedly threatening House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. CBS's Scott McFarlane on an uptick in threats of political violence.
A CBS News review found a surge in threats against members of Congress this year. More than 14,000 investigations so far, surpassing all of 2024.
Arizona's attorney general files a lawsuit that seeks to get Democratic representative-elect Adelita Grijalva sworn in as the state's newest member of Congress. CBS's Stephen Kaufman.
Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays said House Speaker Mike Johnson's obstruction is an unlawful breach of our Constitution and democratic process.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Rapids home for the Maggie Dawn Show, Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 p.m.
The future for Luke Fickell. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports, college football. The Wisconsin Badgers play the number 6th-ranked Oregon Ducks Saturday night in Eugene. The Badgers are 2-5, losing 5 games in a row. Luke Fickell was asked if he knows yet if he'll be back next year at Wisconsin.
No, I don't think any of us have a crystal ball. I've never asked the question. It's not something that I can dwell upon. It's not something that I can't tell you that it's not something that doesn't you don't think about.
Chris McIntosh, the Badgers athletic director, releasing a statement saying Wisconsin remains supporting Fickell in his role as the head football coach. NFL. The Packers play the Steelers in Pittsburgh Sunday night. Linebacker Isaiah McDuffie on what he was most proud of in their win over Arizona.
You know, that's what we've been talking about since the start of the season. You know, just finishing throughout the entire week. That's what we emphasized, and, you know, we got the opt to finish, and we did it.
That's linebacker Isaiah McDuffie with Sports on Mike Clemens.
How serious is youth vaping? Irreversible lung damage serious? 1 in 10 kids vape serious? Which warrants a serious conversation from a serious parental figure, like yourself. Not the seriously know-it-all sports dad, or the seriously smart podcaster. It requires a serious conversation that is best had by you. No, seriously. The best person to talk to your child about vaping is you. To start the conversation, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. While Trump shut down projects, defunded projects, paused infrastructure projects, especially in blue states, in Washington, D.C., they began, well, tearing apart the White House. It's fairly remarkable to me that, you know, not since the British torched the White House has this sacred structure faced such an assault. Only now it's self-inflicted. Our dear leader, Trump, in true MAGA-Lago fashion, is tearing apart the White House's East Wing to build his gaudy, overpriced ballroom. There have been numerous promises that, you know, he wasn't going to damage the building. No, no. And that this new monstrosity would pay total respect and not touch the original walls. Cue the wrecking balls, the cranes, the backhoes, demolishing the facades and tearing down the windows. You know, I guess all in the name of modernization. And I got to tell you, modernization sounds suspiciously like demolition. Kind of does. All to indulge his craving for a 90,000 square foot shrine to himself, dear leader. Because, you know, why settle for mere presidency when you can rule in style? Why the provisions of meager we the people when we can build monuments to Dear Leader? The ostentation and the destruction couldn't be really more symbolic. A man dismantling the very heart of American democracy to build a palace fitting for, yes, a king. History rhymes have never been so tastelessly literal, I gotta tell you. And bravo, Mr. Executive, Unitary Executive, Dear Leader. You've redefined legacy as wrecking what you vowed to protect. And understand, he knows this. This is about his ego, and you look. But he doesn't believe that he's a king. Said, no, not a king. And it got me to thinking, you know, in the course of human events, when it becomes necessary to rise against a leader who wields unchecked power like a monarch, we the people, must declare the reasons compelling us to rebel. Our unitary executive, Donald Trump, like the tyrant King George III before him, has arrogated to himself powers never granted by the people or our representatives. He raises taxes without approval from Congress, tramples the constitutional separations of power. He canceled programs that were duly enacted into law, ignoring the will of the legislature and also the needs of we the people. He directed prosecutors to charge political opponents with really little or zero evidence, weaponizing the justice system to silence what? Dissent. He's deployed National Guard troops in states where governors have objected, subverting federalism and undermining states' rights. Such actions are the very tyranny our founding fathers decried. When a ruler assumes the power to enact laws, administer justice, and govern without oversight or consent, he becomes a despot against whom the people have a right, a duty to defend their liberty. These grievances echo of the original Declaration of Independence's complaints against King George III, but ring clearer and more urgent today. Therefore, I always love throwing a therefore in there. Therefore, we must proclaim that these violations of our constitutional order justify a concerted effort to restore government of the people, by the people, and for the people, and demand accountability, constitutional adherence, and the defense of democratic institutions. Let this declaration stand as a solemn warning that America will not tolerate kings in the guise of presidents, and that the people, you and me, retain the sovereign power to reclaim this republic. Let this be our declaration. Let this be our moment. And coming out of the weekend's rallies, I got to tell you, it's time to reclaim our history in a way that the right had tried to rewrite it. It's time to stand on the hallowed ground of heroes and declare that we will not allow their sacrifices, their blood, sweat, and tears, their vision to be washed away by someone's ego, seeking a legacy, if you will, and that we're going to fight to pass on something worth passing on to our children. And this doesn't have to be right or left. This doesn't have to be Democrat, Republican. This is American. The sad reality is the reports that I've seen coming out of the weekend's rallies, the kind of surveillance, the kind of news media that's been being portrayed, this was anything but a day of patriots taking to the streets to defend their America. It's troubling. Now, a lot of the right-wing rhetoric, and again, my email box full of people, hey, this is civil war. No, this, it doesn't have to be. But this is still, in this moment, a country of, for, and by we the people. And the sooner we come together, especially we in the working class, and demand, like our grandparents' generation did, that we hold certain truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that we all have the right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The sooner we come together around those things, the better it's going to be for all of us. Sure, we're going to have our differences, but I think, at least I hope, that's the start. Got a couple of good folks to talk to today. Richard Hooker from the Teamsters is going to be here to share some thoughts on what happened in Philly. John Logan's going to give us a West Coast view. I'm excited. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back with Teamsters Secretary Treasurer, Local 623, Richard Hooker. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith. And this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 2001. That was the day that Thomas Morris Jr. died from breathing in anthrax. A week earlier, he had been exposed to the deadly poison when an envelope containing the powdery substance was opened at the mail distribution center where he worked. Thomas Morris was a member of the American Postal Workers Union. His union brother, Joseph Kersine, died 2 days later. Both men worked at the U.S. Postal Service Brentwood Processing and Distribution Center in Washington, D.C. The poisoned letters were addressed to Senators Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy. More postal workers at a distribution center in New Jersey also fell ill from exposure to anthrax poisoned mail. In total, 22 people were sickened by anthrax that fall from letters addressed to politicians and news outlets. In addition to those injured, 5 people died, including a 7-month-old infant who was visiting NBC News in New York City with his mother who worked there. Coming the month after the September 11th attacks, the anthrax poisoning sent another wave of fear of terrorism throughout the United States. The Brentwood Distribution Center was closed down for decontamination until December 2003. When it reopened, the facility was renamed for the 2 fallen postal workers. The next year, Senator Joe Lieberman gave an address to the APWU. He said, quote, "The postal workers who were exposed to anthrax and still got the mail out and kept our system running, they are proud union members. I know I'll never forget that, and America won't forget that. All of you at the APWU deserve our respect and our support." One person suspected of the poisonings committed suicide, and the case was closed. No one was ever convicted of the crimes. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, lots of emails from folks on the big rally over the weekend, the organizing that's coming out of it. But one of the weird knocks that I've gotten, and I want to address this in the next couple of minutes with my next guest, is that labor wasn't at the front of it, that this wasn't really labor's moment. And look, I've been saying, you know, labor needs to get out in the streets. We need to do more organizing, more push for, you know, collective bargaining, more wages, hours, conditions, all that good stuff. But the knock is that this wasn't enough. And I know there's got to always be something to divide. And this is kind of part of it. And that's why I've asked my good friend Richard Hooker to come share some thoughts. Richard was one of the folks out in Philadelphia marching in the streets with the folks on No King's Day. He's also Secretary Treasurer of Teamsters Local 623. Check out their website, teamsterslocal623.org. Richard, how are you?
Good, brother. Thanks for having me.
So let's go. Let's get right into this, because, you know, clearly you had some 7 million people across the country finding their way to the streets, meeting face to face with people in the middle of the streets with their signs and their goal of saying we're a country that doesn't believe in kings. Walk me through what you saw.
Well, first of all, I'm glad that the working class is stepping up to the fight, right? No King's Day. These rallies have been a breath of fresh air for a lot of us. This is the second one I've been to. The first time they did it, I was actually on vacation down in my home state of North Carolina. I went to two rallies there. And so this is just, you know, an important moment where we need to do more of this, but not just rallies. I think once the rallies are over, we need to continue this kind of solidarity. People need to be out in the streets more often to show this country and to show that President Trump, that he's going to have a fight on his hand. Not just him, but everybody.
Right.
Everybody that attacks working class people and labor unions, you're going to have a fight on your hand.
So let's get to the main argument that I've gotten from people. And it seems to be one of the only, because the America-hating thing didn't stick. Because these are people who were out in the streets who truly love their country. They took their Saturday off to go out and do something. That's a start. There was no violence. So you can't go, we don't have any reason to attack it there. So now it's about division. And the one division that I think a lot of people have kind of glommed onto is that this wasn't labor's doing. And I'm curious, as a labor leader, one, would you want this to be a labor's event? And two, what did you think of labor's participation in this?
Well, here in Philly, the labor's participation was great. The president of the Philadelphia AFL-CIO, Danny Bowder, did an excellent job in his speech. We had a lot of SEIU people, Unite Here people. So labor was very well represented at Philly's rally. And I'm quite sure in probably bigger cities and metropolitan areas, labor was very very well represented as well. But I do agree that labor does need to take more of an active role in any kind of resistance to what's going on. Because I believe I heard a couple of places. The mayor of Chicago, he talked about a general strike. Dr. Cornel West, he talked about it on a podcast show this past weekend. And so I think people are starting to understand that the only way we're going to get out of this is working class people, the labor leading it. We're going to have to not show up for work, general strike. Let these folks figure out what they need to do without us, because if the workers are not working, there was no profit. There was nothing being moved.
No, we've been waiting for this moment for a while. I've been saying for a long time that workers have been getting the short end of the stick for decades. Our standard of living has been declining for decades. Wages have been stagnant, declining for decades. Health benefits are going away. And look, our government is shut down right now because Democrats are fighting to keep subsidies to make health insurance affordable for low-wage workers and for other folks. It seems like a moment where the kind of populism that we're seeing on the right that seems to be on the rise is something that the left should be grabbing onto of how do we make the lives of working people better with real, actual, tangible plans other than just rhetoric that we're getting out of Trump and the Republicans. So I think labor is perfectly suited for that fight and for that messaging.
I agree. But labor is going to have to get its act together. Right. We can't be split off here over here. This group is doing their thing. This union is doing their thing. All of labor has to be together. And unfortunately, you know, we being a Teamster, you know, I feel somewhat embarrassed that our general president has kind of had adopted this mindset of Teamsters versus everybody. But that doesn't work in this moment. It needs to be Teamsters with everybody fighting against people who want to strip and attack and eliminate our protections, eliminate our contracts. So I think we have to get our act together and really focus on joining with every union organization, every worker, whether they're in a union or not, because it's going to take everybody in the working class to get us out of this mess. So we're going to have to really start, you know, putting this, you know, I'm with the team since I'm with this, I'm with that. No, you are in the working class and we have to work together.
You know, because I had asked the question of whether this was an event that labor should be at the front of. And because the argument is look, you know, we've got a wannabe dictator, a wannabe authoritarian, a wannabe king, if you will. And as I talked about a minute ago, you know, the reality is, you know, you could update the Declaration of Independence based basically on what Trump has done and rewrite it for modern day. This isn't, you know, about union, non-union. This is about working people. This is about Americans. This is about citizens having the right to, well, what our Constitution says. So part of me goes, yeah, I want labor at the front of it because these are the people who are going to fight for democracy and fight for a better opportunity. But I want everybody in. And when you frame it as, you know, O'Brien pushing the Teamsters versus everybody kind of division, I think that's I don't think that's a good thing. I don't think it's a good look.
It's not, especially in this moment, right? Especially when you have, like you said, to your point, a wannabe king, wannabe dictator who has, you know, just came in and just taken away collective bargaining rights for millions of workers, right? And really dismantling working protection groups such as the NLRB, OSHA, and all these other groups that are basically for workers' protections. And he's come in and just dismantled them. And so, again, when you have that idea of this labor union, the Teamsters are not, you know, we are not in fight with everybody else. It's a big, big problem because we can cozy up as much as we think we are to Donald Trump. No. We're not going to get anything out of this. And we have it. And we won't. That's why it's important for all of us in the working class to be together.
No, I don't disagree. And look, you know, the reality is I've heard from a lot of people that, you know, we're kind of staying away from, you know, getting his attention in the hopes that he'll go after others first. But what we do know is eventually in the shark tank, the shark comes for everybody. And eventually it's going to be maybe a little bit later down the road, but it's going to be everyone's turn. And this is why I think events like this, 7 million people getting out in the streets, peacefully assembling, these are important moments. And I got to ask you as an organizer, because now the event's over, there's going to be a whole bunch of dissecting and a whole bunch of postmortem. But, you know, as an organizer, do you see that this could really explode into opportunities, not just to defend democracy and stave off a king, but to really remake this country in the mold that our great grandparents and our grandparents fought for, you know, generations in the past?
Yeah, we're going to have to keep organizing. You hit it. We're going to have to keep pushing. We're going to have more and more events like this. This can't be once every 4 months. This has to be something where we can do more and more regularly, because moments and movements don't just happen. It has to be organized and it has to be a continuous thing. And so I'm hoping that, you know, whatever I can do here in Philly and abroad, that we can continue to have moments like this, because 7 million people out in the street peacefully marching against a person that wants to be a king is impressive. But what would happen, and this is where the organizing comes in, what would happen if we have hundreds of millions of workers out in the street saying, hey, man, we're not working. We're not flying planes. We're not delivering packages. We're not stocking your shelves. Nurses not going to hospitals. Just imagine what that can do.
It's been a long time. So let me ask you this then, because, you know, we've talked about in the past, you know, 1934 being a watershed moment in the labor movement. You saw strikes, you know, all across this country. The Teamsters in 1934 in Minneapolis basically created the, you know, the ability for truck drivers to earn a living throughout, you know, 100 years almost. Could this be that moment where, you know, we finally find that kind of power? We finally find that kind of empowerment?
I think it could be, and it should be. I think we don't have any other choice at this time. The only way that we're going to get our power back, the only way that we're going to stop this fascist overtaking that we are in right now, the only way we're going to stop it, working class people are going to have to be in charge of it. We're going to have to be leading it. We're going to have to participate. We're going to have weaponized solidarity, consistent solidarity, not just on King Day rallies and marches. We're going to have to be together on every step of the way. And again, this could be that moment where it launches us to that point.
Yeah.
And I believe it's coming. Again, the Chicago mayor is talking about it. Different people are talking about it. Sarah Nelson talked about it years ago. Now I think we're good and right to have this moment where labor says, you know what? we shutting everything down. Good luck to you. You guys want to do right and you guys figure it out, then we'll go back to work.
Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, this is one of the knocks that I get against that, because I've been calling for this for a very long time. You know, labor right now is in the private sector, less than 6% of the private sector workforce. We're under 10% now across the board, with a good number of people unable to strike because they're federal or state workers. What does that look like when only a small fragment are the ones leading this charge? Is that enough? Or do you think that everybody else eventually comes on or will come on? I'm curious how you see this in the bigger scheme. Because look, the anger, and I keep saying this, the anger is real. My right-wing MAGA, you know, red hat-wearing friends are angry that the price of eggs hasn't come down, the gas prices are too high, their standard of living is not what they were told it was going to be. They're not leading the lives they were promised. They're not enjoying the birthright that they believed was theirs. And look, the folks on the left, same thing. They're struggling to make ends meet, keep a roof over their head, food on the table. It seems like now is the moment that there should be a powder keg of getting to the streets and demanding better. But this idea that we're so pitted against each other because of red hat or blue hat or union and non-union, do you think it's possible to see something like that happen? As much as, look, on paper, I would love to see it. I just don't know that we as a country in this moment, without something really catastrophic happening, are ready for it.
I believe that the moment is here now. And, you know, hopefully it doesn't take a catastrophe for it to happen. But I think we are at that powder keg moment. Right now, it's not going to take much for workers to understand that they have to do something. I mean, think about it. In my local, we just put out that if this government shutdown is affecting you in any way, we can help you out. And I think what's going to end up happening is once working class people start to see that these benefits that they need and these essential items they can't get because of somebody who wants to be a king who's also a billionaire, doesn't care about you or your family. Once families start to feel that hurt, then that's where you're going to see this explosion.
Yep.
Well, you know what? What do I have left to lose? You're taking everything from me.
Right. And this is why I said I don't think we've hit that catastrophe moment yet, where we don't have anything left to lose. Everyone's like, you know, just duck and cover, keep the powder dry. I hear that stuff a lot. And, you know, the sad reality is when it's over, you'll have dry powder, or whoever comes and takes it from you will have dry powder. So for me, this is a great moment of organizing, a great moment of hope and opportunity. It's will we seize it? Will we have a movement that's willing to lead it? And are there enough people to follow? And we're going to see. I mean, clearly not something you have the answer to, but from what you saw over the weekend, we got to have a little hope, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's hope. Again, 7 million people marching in the street, no violence, no disturbances, peaceful, out in the streets demanding justice, letting folks know this is not a fascist state. We don't bow to a king. It's more of these rallies are going to happen. And the more and more they happen, the more and more people are going to get involved. Because I believe this rally had 2 million more people than the one this summer. So it's growing. And that's what you want to see. You want to see progress.
That is what you want to see. So last question I've got for you. Yesterday we talked a little bit about how creative some of the signs were in a PG way. Anything that you saw, you know, any signs, any messaging that you go, hey, this was, because I love the frog. I love the dancing inflatables. I love the creativity coming out of Portland and places like that. What Philly flavor did we see?
So I'm glad you said Philly flavor. So everybody knows the Eagles, their arch rivals, the Dallas Cowboys. So this one flyer I saw was very, very good. It says, I hate Trump more than I hate the Dallas Cowboys. That was amazing.
Yeah, but Richard, I saw you wearing a Vikings jersey.
Yeah, I'm a Viking fan. I can't help it, man. They They stuck it to me yesterday at the hall. So it was all in good fun.
All in good fun. Look, I'm a Broncos fan. Broncos had a great come-from-behind victory, and it was one of the most amazing games I've seen as a Broncos fan in the, 45-odd years, 50 years I've been a fan. So, see, that's what we need to get back to, that kind of camaraderie. But Richard,
yes.
I appreciate the time. I appreciate the work you do. One of my favorite people in the labor movement, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, brother. Thank you.
Great stuff. Our good friend Richard Hooker, Secretary Treasurer there of Teamsters Local 623 there in Philadelphia. Want to hear your thoughts. Anything fun come out of this or any organizing that you're a part of? I want to hear the groups that are going to spring up out of this. What are you planning to do going forward? Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Want to hear it. Back after this. Stick around.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
Catch Farm Report updates throughout the day from the Midwest Farm Report, right here on 97.5 WFHR.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Cloudy and breezy for tonight with occasional showers and a low close to 40. We'll look for more clouds for tomorrow, a pop-up shower or two possible, and still breezy, a high in the mid-40s. A return to sunshine for Thursday and Friday, high upper 40s to 50. It's 42 right now.
This message is for Karina, our mom who finished her high school diploma at age 28. Hi, Mom. It's Amethyst and Nicholas.
Congratulations on getting your diploma.
You worked so hard and have taught us so much.
We love you.
When you graduate, they graduate. Finish your high school diploma for you and for them. Visit finishyourdiploma.org to find free and supportive adult education centers near you. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Saturday, the big rally all across the country. Millions of people out in the streets. An incredible feat, especially the fact that there were only a handful of arrests across the country, and oh, the creativity. I do love the fact that the frog has been resurrected. Frogs are good now. I guess the message was fascism bad, frogs good. And it got me to thinking about frogs because, you know, as we talked about yesterday on the program, you know, at the beginning, the QAnon folks had taken the frog, and now the frog is back. But the sad reality is, you know, that frog analogy, aren't we all kind of the frog boiling in the water? Because the anger is real on all sides of this. The question is, how do we take that anger and move it forward? That's why when I was looking at my next guest's Facebook page, I came across a quote that took me back to high school. A 1984 quote, until they become conscious, they will never rebel. And after they have rebelled, they cannot become conscious. Made me thinking about maybe we need an education moment. That's why I've asked my good friend John Logan to come share some thoughts. John is a professor at San Diego State University, also the director of labor and employment studies there. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Glad to be on, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the frog. I got to tell you, I love the fact that the frog has been resurrected on the side of good. And I thank Portland for that. But this idea that we're all angry, everybody on all sides of this, and there's some real issue here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think what you said about the protests, I think, is absolutely right. I mean, for the first few months of the Trump administration, if we think back, there was a lot of shock and, you know, things seemed to be, moving in the wrong direction, you know, what a lot of us think of the wrong direction very quickly. And all of these very powerful institutions, you know, Columbia University, big law firms, big media firms, all seemed to be completely rolling over. You know, and that was very depressing because, you know, people think, wow, you know, if these incredible, powerful institutions cannot stand up to the Trump administration, then, you know, what hope is there? But I think gradually, I mean, even though, you know, I mean, there's reason to be more worried now about, you know, the extremes to which the Trump administration is prepared to go in terms of, you know, violating the Constitution, ignoring the rule of law, denying people due process, and so forth. Trump, I would say, sort of does seem more diminished now. People are less hopeless. They're sort of looking at it and they think, you know, this guy's not all-powerful. He seems vulnerable in some ways. The situation doesn't seem so hopeless. And so I think that's why we're seeing bigger and bigger demonstrations, you know, these No Kings demonstrations right. at the weekend, as you said, were the biggest so far. And, you know, when you call for it's very important to have public displays like that, you know, just so that people
can find each other.
Yeah, like-minded and sort of like do not, you know, because the Trump administration wants people to think this is inevitable, that, you know, cliche, but resistance is futile. You know, there's no point in demonstrating, but there is a point. I mean, you know, because it makes people feel less hopeless. And, you know, along with, you know, organizing your workplace and, you know, opposing totalitarianism that way, you know, of course, the American workplace is one of the most sort of totalitarian organizations in society if you're in a non-union workplace. But the other thing I think you can do is get out and demonstrate. Now, it's true, I think, like, you know, when you look at, you know, who's leading these demonstrations, who's organizing them. I mean, there's no clear leadership. You know, it's not like the Democratic Party or the union movement is leading them. And that's sort of good and bad. I mean, it's good because they do seem genuinely, you know, people read in there, you know, look, there's all these No Kings, you know, thousands of them going to take place at the weekend. Here's how you find your local demonstration. On the other hand, you know, for people like us, we would like the labor movement to be playing a leadership role and, you know, to show their members that, you know, they are standing up against what's happening to, you know, certain communities. And, you know, they're standing up to save healthcare. They're standing up against the sort of gutting of social services so that we can give more money to billionaires and to trillionaires. And so the union movement hasn't really been playing a leadership role. It, you know, it has been participating. And, you know, I'm sure if some official from the AFL were here, they would say, oh, you know, that's not true. We've been involved in this and this and this. The demonstrations I saw at the weekend, and, you know, which admittedly might not be representative of, like, you know, other places in the country, there was some union participation, unions like SEIU, public sector unions, teachers unions. But, you know, in a way you expect these, you know, these are the parts of the labor movement you expect to be at a demonstration like this.
Because they're the ones being directly attacked right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the public sector workers, the federal workers, the teachers, the, you know, the unions that represent immigrants and undocumented workers. Yeah. So they were there. But as you said, there's a split, you know, and we all know that there's actually a significant part of the U.S. labor movement, certainly in terms of the membership, but also I think in terms of some of the leadership who are quite supportive of some of the things, maybe not everything, but some of the things the Trump administration is doing, you know, the economic rhetoric about, you know, American jobs for America workers, America first, tariffs, protectionism, bringing back manufacturing. Now, of course, a lot of these things sound good. We would agree with them too.
No, I do agree with some of them.
Yeah.
Just for full disclosure, full open disclosure, I've called for tariffs on certain industries because I do think strategically, in the national interest, you do need to have certain steel productive capacity, and you do need to have jobs. I, you know, I'm not an open borders guy, but I do think in a strategic way, just not the way he's doing it.
No, absolutely. And we know that it's absolutely true, as you said, that, you know, some American industries have been decimated by globalization and by competition from countries with unfair trading practices, who, you know, don't have the labor protections, environmental protections that the United States have, even though our labor protections are nowhere near, and environmental protections are nowhere near as strong as they should be. So, yes, they have been. But, you know, the Trump administration is not going to deliver on these promises. You know, it's not going to deliver on promises to bring back high-paying manufacturing jobs to the United States. It just isn't. So, but, you know, the appeal of right-wing populism in the United States and, you know, as we were talking earlier, globally, to certain sections of the working class is absolutely undeniable, and it's real, and we have to take it seriously. And the labor movement has to take it seriously, because otherwise what we could end up, you know, in 4 years' time, you know, 2028, you know, labor at the next presidential election, I mean, there's a lot to do before we start worrying about that. But, you know, we could end up with a labor movement that's much diminished. You know, first of all, you know, we've kind of got into this frame of mind that labor decline, you know, even us who follow it closely, you know, it's been going on for so long now, you know, 4 decades, 5 decades, gradual decline. But we think, well, it's about 0.5% a year. You know, that's, there's no rule that says it has to be gradual. You know, we could be nearing the edge of the cliff, and over the next few years, there could be a massive decline in union membership and union density, you know, the likes of which we haven't seen in, you know, 100 years, you know. So, you know, we could go, we're like, you know, just under 10% now. We could easily be half of that, you know. And so it could be a much diminished labor movement. And we could also be a very divided labor movement politically, you know, with large parts, you know, with the, you know, some parts of the Teamsters, some parts of the building trades, some parts of the steelworkers and UAW and machinists and other manufacturing unions, you know, supporting. I mean, we see this. It's not just Trump. I mean, Trump, you know, has, I don't know.
No, look, look, the Republicans have been making a play for organized labor for a long time.
For a long time, but you know,
on
not
their,
very
on their grounds.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising to me that a union, you know, is going. Yeah. I always thought it was going to be the building trades.
But it
shouldn't be surprising to anyone that it is the Teamsters. It shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that it's O'Brien, because the Teamsters have always gone their own direction.
Right.
But, you know, what's infuriating is that, look, I think Sean O'Brien is a guy who brings passion and good messaging to what the power of a union can do. I just fear he's screwing it all up by kissing the ring on that side of the aisle.
No, absolutely. I mean, the other thing we had last week is that we had a Senate hearing on labor law reform, and specifically on this bill that Josh Hawley, you know, this right-wing Republican senator from Missouri, is promoting for first contract arbitration, which would be a good thing. You know, something that we support, that, you know, the rest of the labor movement supports. And their thinking is that if you want to get bipartisan support for these kinds of reforms, don't deal with them in a sort of omnibus bill like the PRO Act. Don't throw everything in together. Try and, you know, go for one thing that you can unite people around, and then you can move on from there. Now, that's not a crazy idea.
No, not opposed to it.
No,
I mean, it is. This is one third of what the Employee Free Choice Act was.
Exactly.
What they
thought
George W. Bush would sign, but thanks to Arlen Specter, we never found out. So it's a third of what the reform before the reform was.
Yes, and as you said, you know, people who just dismiss Hawley as a phony, I think are kind of missing the point. I mean, he is on the right. You know, he stands for many things I absolutely abhor, and I always will. And, you know, he's not going to change. But he's very serious about his right-wing populism, and he's very serious about his relationship with Sean O'Brien. and the sort of blue collar wing of the US labor movement, and he wants to be seen as their champion. He thinks that they are socially conservative, but you know, want strong unions and want, you know, the kinds of things that we want: living wage, better benefits, you know, retirement security, and all of that. And so, if you were just to read the transcript from that hearing without any names attached, now, I bet most people would first have difficulty distinguishing between Josh Hawley and Bernie Sanders, because they sounded incredibly similar, and they were both, when it came to the actual labor issues, very good. And second, if you read Sean O'Brien's comments and you took out the things where he was, you know, questions that he was asked by Bernie Sanders, where he didn't want to alienate Hawley and any Republican supporters. So he wouldn't say that he supported the PRO Act, which should be a no-brainer for any union leader. He wouldn't say that Trump's actions in stripping collective bargaining rights from a million federal workers is illegal. Again, you know, any labor leader should be able to say that without even thinking about it. But when he talked about, you know, the impact of not having first contract arbitration, and he talked about the difference between non-union workers in Amazon warehouses and UPS workers who have the benefit of Teamsters representation and the security of a Teamsters collective bargaining agreement, he spoke incredibly powerfully and incredibly eloquently. And so you think, my God, you know, like Hawley, in fact, you know, on those issues and nothing else, he was very good. It's just the other things, you know, the other aspects of right-wing populism, and the anti-immigration rhetoric, the demonizing of certain people, you know, in marginalized groups in society, the selling out of parts of the labor movement, you know, particularly public sector workers and federal workers, you know, you can, those are things no labor leader can do. You just cannot say you stand for working class people as a whole and do those things.
But what do you say, John, to the person who goes, you know, Sean O'Brien's just, he's ahead of the curve on this? Because a lot of the rest of the world, in a lot of segments of the working class, this is kind of the arc that things are going to, because there is an educational divide that is going on right before our eyes. And I think most working people, they're feeling the vulnerability of what's coming. They've seen what's happened over the past couple of generations as industries have transitioned out of existence. And they know that their future is not great. I'm one of those people who, when automated trucks come into place, we're done.
Right.
So
I know
you kind of.
And that's the environment I grew up in. You know, like, you know, my father worked in, you know, shipyards, and then he worked in a steel mill, and then he worked in a manufacturing facility. And, you know, it's that working class that have been the losers of economic globalization and technological change that we've seen over the past, you know, 2, 3, 4 decades. And it's also that working class that has been not served well by centrist left parties, you know, like the Democratic Party in the United States and, you know, the Labour Party under people like Tony Blair and, you know, Keir Starmer, current leader. I mean, all of which, you know, all of those people did some good things, but, you know, that left behind working class, their conditions got worse and worse and worse. And they became alienated from both parties to a large extent. But, you know, what also happened, we may have talked about this before, is that the economies in those communities really fell apart more quickly than almost anyone anticipated. You know, the jobs and the economy that sustained a sort of decent life, you know, we call it in this country, we call it a middle-class lifestyle for blue-collar workers, but that sustained a decent life for people without college degrees or, you know, high levels of education, they just fell apart really quickly. And neither Democrats nor Republicans have had good answers or any answers most of the time for what to do to replace that and how to rebuild that economy. But in the case of the Democrats, unfortunately, they often haven't even had candidates who can speak the language of these communities. And what that means is that people are very vulnerable to, you know, these right-wing demagogues like Trump, who come in, you know, riding on the white horse, saying, only I have the answer to your solutions. And of course, he doesn't. He's not, ultimately, these people will not benefit from Trump's policies.
And we haven't.
But, you know, people are vulnerable to those appeals. And, you know, say the labor movement, you know, having a union is not, you know, we always sort of thought, oh, but union members won't fall for that. Union members, you know, we have our unions, you know, to tell us, to explain who's really on our side when it comes to politics. It's not true. I mean, I wish it were true, but, you know, I mean, I used to, you know, say this, you know, about even about West Virginia, you know, part of the country, you know, far better than me. But I remember in 2016, I'll tell this story very quickly. The very smart historian at Georgetown University, Michael Kazin, he wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal about how it was the decline of unions that was responsible for West Virginia becoming so Republican. And I say, no, that's not true. It's not that simple. First of all, West Virginia, as you know, was a Democratic state long after, you know, the heyday of the miners union. I mean, long after the sort of system of, you know, unionization and collective bargaining and the decline of the mining industry. So, but second, you know, unions by themselves are not a miracle defense against right-wing populism. You know, people can go to their union hall, you know, those that, you know, unions that still, people still do this, and say, you know, I'm with Trump, who's with me? And, you know, probably find a lot of sympathetic, like-minded people. So, you know, just having a union by itself will not protect us against the rise of right-wing populism. It's going to take more than that.
Yeah. So last question, you know, real quick, you know, does this rally, does this weekend, does this move in a right direction? Do you see this as the beginning of something positive, or do you think the cast has already died? And,
well, you know, there's different ways of looking at this. And, you know, I know everyone always wants to find a positive message in there. We all do. Like, you know, we don't want to be told, oh, we're all doomed, you know, like it's authoritarianism is going to win out. But you also don't want to be told, you know, bullshit. You know, you don't want to just, or like some, like, oh, the long arc of history bends towards justice. It's like, you know, when people say that, say, what? Is that all you've got? You know, I need something more real. I need something more concrete. And what I would say, Rick, and I genuinely really, really believe this, and I think this could actually happen, is that, you know, if Trump succeeds, then, you know, we're moving towards a more and more authoritarian country. And, you know, for people who believe in the kind of, you know, values I believe in, you know, that's a very dark place. But I think that it's very, very far from certain that he will succeed. I think the whole thing could implode. I think, you know, politics and society is very unpredictable and very volatile at the moment. And if that happens, more could be in play in terms of unions, in terms of stronger labor rights than has been true for many decades.
No, I've been saying, look, once it gets bad,
yeah,
the solutions are going to come out of our suffering. And suffering is coming.
We're not going to go back to business as normal anytime soon. You know, these, right. I mean, we've talked about this before, and be very quick about that. These Republicans are you know, they're out to destroy the administrative state, including institutions like the National Labor Relations Board. They're not going to leave it in place so the Democrats can take it over again and reverse what they have done. They want to destroy it for a generation. So the old system is not coming back. So the question is, if Trump does not succeed, we will have the opportunity to create something new and more meaningful.
Yep.
And
there you go.
I think that is it.
I'm right there with you. John, as always, great stuff. Appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Rick. I appreciate being on.
Our good friend John Logan, professor and director of labor and employment studies there at San Francisco State University. Want to hear your thoughts. You think he's right? You think it's not far from certain? Do you think there's a possibility you turn the ship around? Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Gotta tell you, I think John's absolutely right. The rise of right-wing populism in the American labor movement, and look, globally, is a significant threat. And it's not surprising that there is a labor leader in the U.S. who's moving in that direction. Look, this is my problem with Sean O'Brien. I'll be honest, this courting of the right wing, because maybe you're going to get something I have a problem with, because I know I believe nothing comes out of it that's going to be any good for working people. And understand, you know, these populist movements, it's all about weakening what built the most prosperous working class in history. This idea that we're going to just, you know, we're going to promote pro-corporate policies. You're going to limit the ability of labor to go too far. We're going to give you a little bit, which is why I find it interesting that it's a third of what the Employee Free Choice Act was, and nowhere close to what the PRO Act is. But it is really about divide and conquer of the working class. Many of Trump's Project 2025 initiatives explicitly aim to restrict union rights. Prohibiting union card checks, attacking workplace diversity initiatives. These are tools that the corporatists use to keep people, working people, in their place. And look, the left, Democrats, labor parties across this globe, across this country, better figure it out quick. They better figure out how to talk to working people again and kind of offer some kind of populist message that isn't go get those people or hooray for us and the heck with them. It's not a good position we're in, but we had better figure it out. And I'll tell you, I think these rallies are a good start, point in the right direction. And I'm hoping that the organizing that comes out of this, the networking, the relationships, and the brainstorming comes to get us an America worth having and one worth passing on. Because understand where we're heading is right back to the future. We are living the Gilded Age. We got a lot of work. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, podcast, and as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Progressive Insurance.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. A food crisis could be looming in many states due to the government shutdown, which is set to move into a 22nd day. KCBS's Matt Bigler in California.
Governor Gavin Newsom is warning that federally funded CalFresh benefits could be delayed or even halted next month for some 5.5 million residents if Congress fails to reach a deal to end the government shutdown.
We haven't broken any records, but we're not necessarily breaking any new ground in terms of breakthroughs.
Many food banks are already struggling due to a decrease in government assistance. John Dolby says he's worried about recently laid off or furloughed federal employees.
There's a lot of people in need. There's a lot of people that are thrown out of work, as a matter of fact.
Nearly two-thirds of CalFresh recipients are children or the elderly. Matt Bigler for CBS News, San Francisco.
Some states, including Pennsylvania, New York, and Texas, are warning that Americans who rely on food stamps to pay for groceries may miss out on SNAP